Shall we begin? So if you dig out from deep inside your knapsacks and things that one-page handout I gave you last week, I've got a few more if you've managed to destroy or lose them in the meantime. I'll be back and do this again. The idea of the causality of fate, and here I'm just borrowing Habermas's version rather than the one I did. The argument of that was that any violation of the structures of our rational life together, to which all claim equally, affects everyone equally. That is, what is meant by an ethical totality is that it can be disrupted by the deed of the criminal, and that unity or totality can only be restored by insight into the indivisibility of suffering due to alienation. Now, Habermas, on page 325 in that handout, quotes and I just bring it here because it's so pretty, a beautiful passage from Klaus Heinrich, where Heinrich gives this idea a slightly religious image, but then modulates it in interesting ways. He says, keeping the covenant with God is the symbol of fidelity. Breaking this covenant is the model of betrayal. So notice that although the relationship is to the covenant, the terms are really fidelity and betrayal. And now you can read to the whole, since the covenant is simply the ground of the unity of the image of our life together. To keep faith with God is to keep faith with life-giving being itself, in oneself and others. To deny it in any domain of being means breaking the covenant with God and betraying one's own foundation. Wherever God appears here, just read spirit. Thus, betrayal of another is simultaneously betrayal of oneself. This is the key Hegelian notion. So the depth of betrayal of another is betrayal of oneself. So the problem of betrayal is not that you don't get adequately recognized, it's that you, right, have yourself failed in your self-relationship in a certain way. And every protest against betrayal is not just a protest in one's own name, but in the name of the other at the same time. That is, you cannot protest anything in your own name without simultaneously acting for another. The idea that each is potentially a covenant partner in the fight against betrayal, including anyone who betrays himself and me, is the only counterbalance against Stoic resignation, already formulated by Parmenides when he made a cut between those who know and the mass of the ignorant. That is, this argument, a betrayal of the other is betrayal of myself as well, is the only way to have a non-Platonic ethicality. Because otherwise, ethics is always going to be just a form of stoicism. Unless the stakes of my action, unless the stakes of my action are intrinsically in that action, the stakes of the totality of which I am a member, unless that is the case, then morality simply becomes a private game between me and some abstract absolute. And there is no other alternative. The concept, and therefore, of course, I mean, Kant knew that and was trying to think that in the moral law, right? But he did so because he wanted it not to be about the difference between those who know and those who don't. He wanted the moral law to be something that was implicit, always already in everybody's experience of obligation. But he made it an abstract relationship to law rather than actually building in the relationship to the other. So the relationship to the other is always mediated by the idea of law, and therefore my obligation is to the law and different to the other. The concept of enlightenment, familiar to us, is unthinkable without the concept of a potentially universal confederation against betrayal. And then the final sentence of the paragraph, picking this up, Habermas says, in the restlessness of the real conditions of life, there broods an ambivalence that is due to the dialectic of betrayal and avenging force. Avenging force is what I'm interested in here. That's the causality of fate. That is, what happens when I do a deed that transgresses against the totality? What's wrong with Heinrich and what's wrong with Habermas is that, at least even on this image, it is a wildly overly moralized account of our united life and our life together. It somehow relies on a tightly bound conception of ethical totality. What Hegel begins doing in the first chapter on spirit is shifting the idea of transgressive action and criminality, acting against our life together, in another direction. Hegel came to see that the best analogy for transgressive action is tragic action. And what I'm going to say over the next 15, 20 minutes is something like Hegel wants to think of tragedy, use the idea of tragedy as a post-liberal conception of how to think about the meaning of action, überhaupt. So he wants to use tragedy, for reasons I'll come to, as part of a broader theory of action. Tragedy gives us, I'm going to suggest, a new conception of action. Or an old one. For Sophocles, tragic action maps the limits of culture, above all of human self-sufficiency and of social self-sufficiency. That is, Sophocles supposes that what he is investigating are the limits of the new self-authorizing form of life that the Greeks were embarking on in the name of, Sophocles speaking for, the older religious ethos, and which Aristotle came to read. When Aristotle reads the tragedies, he reads that older religious ethos. That ethos is simply a code name for nature. For nature as of the condition and limit of culture. Now, what Hegel sees in tragic action is in part that the limits of culture as such, I'm sorry, is not the limits of culture as such, but the limits of Greek culture. And because what he sees there is the limits of, let's call it, agent self-sufficiency. Nonetheless, the argument I want to push is that the pattern of the causality of fate, of the return of the repressed in Hegel, is a version. Remember, we talked about experience as a turning around and then a moving on to the next step. In Aristotle's account of tragedy, this is peripeteia and anagnorisis, conversion and recognition. That the turning point in the tragedy is the moment, right, when Oedipus says, "Oh my God, it's me I've been searching for. I'm the guy who did all those nasty things," right? Suddenly there's a turning around, right? And a recognition of the situation he's been in. And I want to suggest that it's this notion of conversion and recognition in the tragic sense that lies behind Hegel's notion of experience, which is to say that Hegel is going to use Greek tragedy not only for an understanding of ethical life, of Zyklakait, which means roughly, Zyklakait means roughly in Hegel, spirit in the form of immediacy. Spirit in the form of immediacy, that is, without history and without reflexivity. Ethical life is not the same as spirit. It's a thinner version of spirit, in the spirit without, in its immediate manifestation, without an understanding of itself as historical and a reflection on that historicity. Hegel's going to use Greek tragedy not only to think about Zyklakait, but as part of a transformed conception of action. Well, let me try the question this way. Let me first map something up here. Spirit. Agent. Concept. Let's start with ethical life, tragedy, and retrospection. We'll add on to that in a moment. I said that the spirit is about the structure of the relationship between individual and community. how does an individual agent relate to a larger whole of which he or she takes himself to be a particular part? Well, let me try another word for spirit, since I know the word spirit makes people creep out. It's worth remembering that Hegel really came into France via both Kojem and Jean Hippolyte. And Hippolyte had one remarkable student, namely Foucault. So let's say that power, in Foucault's sense, is simply a word for spirit. I just take this, anyone who's read Hegel and read Foucault, it just looks obvious. Not only does it look obvious, it's been Judy Butler's whole career. That's all she's done is work up Foucaultian ideas with Hegelian energy. So the subject, as Foucault puts it, is produced by power. Power only exists by people acting, producing, and reproducing themselves and the forms of power they are parts of. Power acts in and through the subject. Agency exceeds the power by which it is enabled. The purposes of power are always both the purposes of agency and the purposes of reproducing itself in opposition to agency. The foundationalism of the subject, namely the belief that we each have, that we are not conditioned and that we are autonomous, is itself an effect of power, an effect achieved by a reversal and concealment of its prior working. That's the way in which Foucault gives power a Heideggerian twist, that power operates by concealing itself as power. Probably this isn't the way Johanna talks about Foucault. But anyway, spirit can only affect itself by hiding itself. Or that's been its history. There is a mutual non-reducibility, a mutual dependency on this dual structure. Power is not outside of me, nor can it be exclusively identified with me. Now, the original idea that we began with in thinking about how to talk about consciousness examining itself was that we would compare a concept of an object with the experience of that object. Now, in this new dispensation, now that we're in spirit, what's going to happen is that we are now agents who produce and reproduce, and because of the hiddenness of power, act in disregard of the conditions of the possibility of action. So in the same way in which cognitively we act in abstraction from the conditions of cognition, really what's going on here is going to be an account of how various practices act in disregard of the conditions of power. The movement of this structure of acting in disregard of the conditions of possibility of agency is the causality of fate.
in acting in disregard of the conditions of the possibility of my agency, those conditions of possibility act back on me. And I can only experience that act backing on me as the defeat of my agency. As fate. Something. I have undermined my own conditions of agency and so in Hegel, the notion of spirit, call it power, you can see why Foucault spends so much time trying to say why he's not an Hegelian, right? Because he is. No one, you know, he doth protest a bit too much. The notion of spirit replaces the notion of united life, and the structure of the phenomenological unfolding is going to concern the movement of spirit itself. So the original thought, namely of criminality as law-breaking, and we discovered that this narrows the notion of the kind of action we have to think about. Hegel realized that he could only use the notion of the causality of fate as a significant model of human action if it was not coextensive with moral wrongdoing or acting from vicious motives. Not every act of separation, and that's what we're interested in, acts of separation, acts of, let's use a bland word, an Hegelian word, acts of negation. Later on, I'm going to call these acts of transgression. Not every act of negation or transgression involves the possibility of losing a world, that involves the possibility of losing a world, is done in order to injure or harm. It's not done for the sake of injuring or harming. Even in the spirit of Christianity, Hegel argued that there can be transgressive actions that are morally blameless. Now, why am I sweating here? Why is he sweating so much? Because we've got to think about a notion of wrong or harm or responsibility that's different from or wider than moral harm or moral injury or moral responsibility. Now, Hegel thought that he could do this. He says that fate can be aroused even by guilt without crime. How can there be guilt without crime? That's what I guess I'm interested in. How can there be guilt without crime? Well, part of the help comes from just the German word schuld for guilt, because it also means, other than guilt, it means caused by or responsible for. Where being caused by and responsible for something happened are obviously interlinked notions. So all it takes is that you are responsible for something that happened, and that your being responsible for it is irrespective, and this is the crux of the matter, of whether you intended it or not. That you cannot think about action, as we already discovered, if you put intention at the center. That the unintended consequences of action are occasions for guilt in this sense. Mutual recognition, when we get there in another 10 weeks or so, is going to be a recognition of responsibility and indebtedness, not caused by guilt, moral guilt, but caused by a certain kind of awareness. Well, what kind of awareness? Well, we do stuff all the time which we did not intend to do. And to come to recognition is to recognize what one has done. So, of course, what occurs is normally the consequence of some sort of negation, transgression. But I suffer because of the consequences of these actions. And the suffering, my sense of responsibility is the return of the oppressed. That is destiny or is fate. Tragic recognition is Hegel's original model of how recognition occurs. Recognition is always a turning of consciousness. And if recognition is first of all tragic recognition, then it follows that Hegel's model of action is at least in part tragic action. As I'm going to suggest in a moment, Terry Pinkard mentioned this, but I think he didn't go far enough. For Hegel, various literary forms give a privileged access to the understanding of the meaning of action. And I put what I want to say this way, that literary forms are to human agency and individuality what language games are to a form of life. That is, that we are the kind of people who are agents, right? Only gets picked up and thematized adequately by us having certain types of literary forms, certain types of narrative forms. So the thought is that narrativity is the language game, narratives of various kinds, including tragic narratives. Narrativity is the language game appropriate to the kinds of being who are fundamentally self-conscious agents in the world. And I'm saying you're not going to be able to think about the meaning of agency. What agency is, and I use a platonic phrasing, apart from thinking about these narrative forms. That these narrative forms are the forms intrinsic to these types of phenomena. And above all, what tragedy is going to show, and this is going to take us throughout the whole of the chapter on spirit, but it's going to start right away at the beginning. What tragedy shows above all is that the meaning of an action can only be had in retrospection. That almost all theories of action are prospective.
Right? They all have a belief in desire model or the intentional model or the purposive model. They're all futural. They're Sartre with all his projects. Everyone thinks of agency as the agent projecting themselves forward. And the discovery of tragedy, discovery of the epic, even before tragedy, is that that view of action is partial and inadequate. Even to understand the simplest meaning of an action. And that actions, in principle, cannot be comprehended adequately. And when I say comprehended adequately, I mean what the action is, therefore what you have done, and therefore who you are and what you have desired, except retrospective. That action requires retrospection. And the reasons for this I'm going to mount up ad nauseum, since, as I've already indicated, much of the chapter on spirit is about the meaning of action. That really is Hegel's topic here. So the strategy of the chapter on spirit the goal of the whole chapter is for spirit to become conscious of itself as spirit. That's it. Spirit has to become conscious of itself as spirit, which means you and I, since we are we that are eyes, and I, you know, have to become conscious of ourselves as fully spiritual beings, in Hegel's sense. The original struggle for recognition between Antigone, think of her as particularity or the slave, and Creon, think of him as the spokesman for universality. This struggle is resolved. The struggle between Antigone and Creon, I want to say, is resolved only at the end of the entire chapter on spirit. The entire chapter on spirit, I'm going to argue, is really about what is opened up by the fracturing of Greek ethical life, by Antigone's transgressive action. Antigone, I'm going to argue, who looks like an exception, who looks like, Lacan says, Antigone is just the death drive. Full stop. Kind. Of course she does love death. Right? She says so. Let death be my friend. You know. There's a lot of death driving. But I'm going to argue that for Hegel, and this is against nearly every reading of Hegel I know, Antigone becomes the model of all human agency. It is her deed that sets the whole thing off. And that mutual recognition, when it comes, will involve recognition of the nature of action, by which I mean that all significant human action is transgressive and negative. That human beings can only act, if I may put it this way, by acting badly. That's just a jeu d'esprit. Tragedy, but that's what tragedy wants to say as well, right? Tragedy is simply that everything ends badly in action. Tragedy is the model for both transgression and how, if it comes about, reconciliation comes about. So the chapter as a whole
is itself like an extended tragic scenario. Now, Alan Speight, in his book called Hegel, Literature and the Problem of Agency, very nicely says he's picking up an idea of mine, but I didn't say it, he did. And he argues the following. He says that the entire chapter on spirit is really organized along different literary forms, and that the different literary forms each give a privileged access to action. So it's not just tragedy, but comedy. Comedy. How do I want to do it? Yeah. And let's call it comedy and romantic novel. And this is going to be the section on culture. And this will be the section on morality. And the agent concepts are going to be, comedy is going to be theatricality. And the romantic novel is going to be about forgiveness. Okay. So the argument's going to go something like this. That two dominant issues, or that concern action for Hegel, are first the question of retrospectivity, and the other is theatricality. The sheer for anotherness and the sheer spectacle, the way in which all my action escapes me and is for another. And then in relationship to these two, the problem of forgiveness. The phenomenology itself can be regarded as a successor narrative to these literary forms, so that it's not as if Hegel's in competition with Schelling. It's rather he's much more in competition with earlier understandings of action, and the phenomenology is a way of trying to provide a synthesis of this. Now, Hegel's method here is to move from certainty, which has been our topic till now, to necessity. Hence, a move from a concern with the hold we can have on a particular claim to a much better topic, the hold various claims can have on us. Right? All the characters up to now have been trying to say, I'm certain. But now I'm going to say, no. Now we're going to have to find ourselves being claimed and having to do something with things that, as it were, point us out and say, you're the one. So the move is from a voluntarist, prospective, intentional conception of action, one that is built on desire and belief or purpose, to an account of action that is, and I like Speight's word here, corrigibilist. Subject to negotiation, subject to change, subject to others coming in, and retrospective. In the latter case, and this is the where it gets interesting. The question is, again, remember the question we've been trying to ask is, what makes a belief mine? What makes anything mine? What makes an action mine? And I'm saying certainly not intention. Certainly not that I intended or desired it or wanted it. That's the bad subjectivism we have to get past. We have to say that for Hegel, and it's going to take the next 7 or 8 weeks to get this clear, we are in our actions, not through the desires motivating them, but through how they express us as agents. So in part, I'm going to be going for what I call an expressivist theory of action. For this, the mindness of an action is subject to intersubjective negotiation, and it is through the practical identity of the agent which occurs through those negotiations that recognition occurs. I might put the point in another way. The phenomenology has a therapeutic or pedagogical task. And that's the task of cultivating or transforming the reader into the space of reasons. And not just any old space of reasons, but our space of reasons in particular. So the transition to spirit, which generate a certain reconsideration of the claims of Greek ethical life, occurs in a way that now seems, and now this is, I think, the question Paul was asking at that time, that now seems to press on the individual. So the argument of the movement to Greece is what Hegel has to show is that its claims are claims we are answerable to. So it's no longer the case, right, that we're following the path of naively finding ourselves in a space. It's rather the converse, that now we are being presented, and this was clearly the German experience, with claims issuing from somewhere else that we were supposed to be answerable to. As if we could not know ourselves unless this historical emergent idea could be either acknowledged or cut down, one or the other. Okay. I'll start here next week, and one of the things I want to think about, or you to think about, is how everything about action is mediated. Great Hegelian word. How the desires you act on are not your desires, they came from somewhere else. And moreover, you don't know what they are. And furthermore, you don't know what they mean until after you act. And furthermore, what you've done when you acted is not up to you. And on and on. We have
and we must have. I want to be very clear. This is why Hegel is so hard. We have an intrinsic first-person understanding of ourselves. And Hegel is trying to say that that natural and spontaneous view from the inside is not wrong because science tells us it's wrong or because biology... No, it's not that kind of outside. It's that we are not inside ourselves in the way that we think we are. That our very insides are already an outside of ourselves in a deep and responsive way, and that the nature of action, not thought, not theory, not reflection, but action, is the movement of ourselves outside of ourselves in our relationship to others. If we get lucky, we have a bright, sunny day and a good wind, someone might tell us who we are. Okay.
Antigone next week. We'll get there.